Hey, it's Mike McEntee. It is Friday, and that means that you have survived another week of the Trump administration. Congratulations to you. It is a sunny Sunday here. Sunny Friday. I wish it was sunny and a Sunday, but it is Friday here. And I have to ask you, when you started when you went to bed last night and you asked yourself, what would be less probable? An end to hostilities between North and South Korea, or ABBA reuniting after 35 years. And then you wake up and find out that both happened. But I know they're opposite ends of the scale, but in terms of probability, I had them about in the same bucket. So is there more sizzle than steak with North Korea and South Korea's sudden peace agreement? Now, we're going to be talking to Jack Rice, our CIA guy who knows all this stuff, a little bit later on the program. But first, we're going to check in here with Bob Ney of Talk Media News and what else is roiling Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Oh, thank you. And tell Jack I said hi. He's a colleague of mine. Fantastic mind. What a great guy.
He is a great mind. We're going to get in. Yes. Jack is going to talk about kind of some of the some of the stuff behind the scenes with that, and whether or not we should be concerned. But I'm wondering, just Bob, what's the general reaction to that whole North Korea, South Korea, we're going to shake hands and be good buddies and get rid of nukes announcement that came out this morning?
I think everybody's so shocked. They're just kind of a bit quiet. People are starting to have comments on both sides. I think most of the members of Congress, though, are just kind of sitting back, waiting just to see what's going on. And also, there were a lot of back-channel workings on this thing with we found Pompeo, we find out, went over there, and then President Trump said, well, he really kind of accidentally ran into Kim Jong-un. Okay, good luck,
I was just going down to the 7-Eleven, and Kim Jong-un was there. What the heck?
There he was. I went to the barber. We were sitting next to each other in the chair.
I would not want to have his barber.
Well, I told a friend of mine, if they do ever attack him, they need to go after that barber. They got to find that guy.
I think we can start a GoFundMe on how to get rid of Kim Jong-un's barber. A lot of shocked people in Washington, D.C. about that. And as I mentioned, we'll get into that a little bit more. But the substance of that, do people believe that this is real, that this is really going to happen?
Well, I think they do. But again, China's pulled a lot of strings on this. This kind of the dominoes didn't all of a sudden magically start to happen. But look, everybody out there that's been there any amount of time, I was there when President Clinton tried his effort, and I supported that, for example, when I was there in Congress, and we've watched other presidents try to do things. But everybody knows with this crew over there, you just don't know until the ink's signed and you got to verify it. So I think that's in the back of everybody's mind. Long way to go yet.
A long way to go. The topic, though, that is kind of dominating the talk in D.C. today beyond North and South Korea has to do with the House chaplain who has been let go. And apparently this is politically motivated. Tell me what you know on this.
These are really sensitive. When I first arrived in Congress, they had a House chaplain. And then there was a new speaker. It was Newt Gingrich. And he got a House chaplain. They had a House chaplain. Then it came to Speaker Hastert. And he got the wise idea to kind of form this panel to have a bunch of input as to who to pick. And traditionally, the speaker picks the House chaplain because it's considered a House officer, like the sergeant of arms of the House or the information director, the CEO of the House. So Hastert, this is the last time there was a big brouhaha. Hastert picked somebody, and then people were upset, and they thought he was biased against, I think, Catholics at the time. I can't really remember the whole scenario. So that kind of lay dormant for a while. Now, this is a huge controversy, and I think this one is not going to just sort of end today, because now we're hearing probably the fourth or fifth reason why the House chaplain was relieved of his duties and had done so quick and done in an election year, let's face it, And then there's a question of anti-Catholic bias. He's a Catholic. The speaker supposedly, it was because he said a prayer about the tax relief, Mike, that maybe was saying, hey, yeah, treat people fairer, but we're finding out that he did an article for the National Review. Supposedly, Speaker didn't like that. And then the Speaker has told a private meeting gathering out there of people, Republicans, that it was because of his availability. He wasn't available. And also his pastoral counseling. Peter King of New York, a Republican, is very angry, and he's kind of led the charge on the speaker on this thing. So, I mean, what do they mean, his, you know, pastoral counseling? I mean, how many members complained about it? Was it one or two or three? So I think they've got a controversy that's not going to end today.
It is strange, and the things that get under people's skin here in D.C. This is not an inconsequential position. I mean, this is somebody who starts off the house every day with a prayer and is on salary there, gets paid, I assume, a decent amount of money. So it's not just a little, you know. I mean, here in Minnesota, they invite somebody in every day, a different pastor or a different religious person to come in and say the prayer. And there's nobody that is here in the House or the Senate that does that stuff. But this is kind of a big deal, a big position.
It is. Now, and I really don't want to be quoting wrong on your show, but the last of my memory when I was there, it paid like $125,000, $140,000, somewhere along that line, okay?
Oh, that, yes, that doesn't go anywhere in Washington.
Yeah, well, yes, true. But it paid, you know, decently. And then there were counseling hours, and they would start the prayer. And what we did out there, and this is the procedure today, if the house chaplain can't be there to start the prayer, then members get to pick people, you know, from their areas. You can have, you know, whoever you want to come out, and members take turns picking them. And then at key times, the chaplain starts. But basically, the availability of the chaplain for people with problems, that way they have confidential ability as members, you know, to be able to talk to them. And, yeah, it's a, you know, the position is a big deal. And this time, the controversy, like I said, seems to go in three or four different directions, which kind of doesn't make sense, you know, Mike, because either there's sort of a main reason or are they starting to make up reasons? I don't know. But what should be a very simple situation has now become very complicated.
Next story here is something that I'm not surprised on two levels. One, it released on a Friday. And number two, House Republicans, after doing their investigation of Donald Trump colluding with Russia, came back and said, didn't happen. You got a chance to look at the documents, I mean, at least what you can read. What did you see in there?
Yeah, and you make a really great point that left my mind about released on a Friday. You know, that's the interesting day to release anything, especially if you don't have something that's like pizzazz. And basically what the Republicans, now, and I kind of compared this to you know, Comey and some of the ways he functioned, you know, when he went after Hillary. He tried to say one thing, then tried to cover his base with another. You know, I think he did, you know, both sides out of his mouth in a way. And that's what they're doing here. Because what they're saying is that there was no collusion. This is House Republicans. House Intel Committee, and by the way, the report is heavily redacted with black lines through it. But they said that the Trump campaign did not collude with Russia. So that's the headline, right?
Okay,
and they blamed
all heard
U.S.
That.
Intelligence
yeah.
agencies for tradecraft failings, whatever, frankly, that is. But here's the bottom line. They also say the Trump campaign made a series of, these are quotes, imprudent, ill-advised, questionable decisions in holding meetings with Kremlin-linked people and trying to make contact with WikiLeaks, but conclude the investigation did not uncover any criminality. This is from the supporting side of Trump.
So basically, they were trying to do stuff, but they were so bad at it, we really can't call them criminals. Is that what this says?
Well, they were, yeah, with Kremlin-linked.
Kremlin-linked, okay.
And they said, well, there was no real criminality. But that's, you know, according to them, but they're talking about Kremlin-linked connections out with WikiLeaks, you know, et cetera.
Now, the Democrats, I think, have a very different take on this. Have we seen, has what they've written seen the light of day, or are we going to go through that whole thing again?
No, I think they'll speak out on it, but the problem that we have is all of the redacted, you know, the redacted material. But, you know, obviously the Democratic side says, hey, you know, this was crafted the way they wanted it to be crafted.
We're speaking with former Congressman Bob Hayes with Talk Media News. We're going through some of the bigger stories that are cropping up here on Friday. in Washington, D.C. And the big story this week was Dr. Ronnie Jackson. He was going to be the head of the Veterans Affairs. And then suddenly he wasn't going to be because he took himself out of the running. So that's sort of solved, but there's all these lingering questions about the things that brought him down. Tell me about what we knew that we found out today.
Well, this isn't the end of the story on this, because there's new allegations, rumors of the pill mill that was out there, all the allegations personally against him, but also a lot of allegations about writing prescriptions, quality of his ability, to perform his job. So what you have is not a story that goes away because he wasn't appointed to the VA. You now have a story about the physician to the President of the United States and what kind of condition is he in, what is he capable, of in the areas of performing his job. So this story definitely has a ton of legs to it, because they're going to have to get down to the bottom of it. Again, he's physician to the President of the United States.
Now, he was physician not just to Donald Trump, but he was physician to Barack Obama, which you would say, okay, so this has been going on for some time. How does something like this just stay out of the news? Is it just kind of like don't ask, don't tell? It's nobody wants to talk about it? Were there whispers about this, or is this a complete shock to everybody that this is what was going on behind the scenes?
It was a shock to everybody, and you've asked a question. I've been thinking this through. I've been on congressional delegation trips. I know how they function. The military goes there, and I'm he's a rear admiral, right?
Right, in
designation, and I'm thinking, all right. Supposedly, I'll say allegedly, he knocked on the door. He was drunk on a woman's door, and it almost woke the president up on the trip. And if all these things happen, was there a fear within the military to say something? I mean, either these things simply didn't happen, or they happened and everybody covered them up, because there was not a whisper of anything. Nothing. Normally you'll hear things, right? And especially in D.C. Absolutely nothing. So I don't know if everybody just kept quiet about it because of his position, which is potentially possible. He was around a lot of military people.
I mean, most people have never really heard of him until he got out there and did his report on Donald Trump, saying, oh, he's in wonderful shape for a guy who's nearly, how many pounds and not quite as tall as he said he was. And everybody looked at him and said, you got to be kidding. And he was smiling away through this. And that's where everybody started going, are you together? And then this just kind of confirmed what a lot of people were saying when they saw him. It said, this guy is just maybe nuts. Is he going to continue in that position, or who decides who the White House physician is? The president, I assume?
And the president, unless he can clarify every single allegation, because now it is questioned about his ability to have actually done that test and been honest about it and accurate, but unless he can take care of every single allegation, because some of them are really bad, I don't know how he, in fact, would be able to stay on that job.
Yeah, there are so many scandals in the Trump administration, it's hard to keep track of them all. You need a spreadsheet, and we'll just have to add that one to the list and see where it goes. The other big thing in Washington, D.C. was, again, we had two big visits this week. We had French President Emmanuel Macron. He got a state dinner, 3 days, a mini military parade, an address to Congress. And then German Chancellor Angela Merkel shows up. She gets a hearty handshake, a working lunch, and a total time of 3 hours before she's ushered out the door. A big contrast between these two, but really kind of the same message from both of them, isn't it?
Yes, it went from ooh la la to hello, goodbye, thank you, is what it did. and the whole style and everything. One of them fit in more with Trump, let's face it, the French, the dinner, et cetera, the wives, were dressed up. But even though Merkel's was, obviously a very downplayed visit, it was the same issues, the tariffs, the trade, and in particular Iran. Because, Europe is very, very concerned about where we head with Iran, and they're very concerned if we actually pull out of this deal, although some Republicans are starting to change their mind in the Senate all of a sudden. But if we pull out of this deal, then where does that leave everything? Does Iran then build more centrifuges and does it reverse everything? But yes, same message, but wow, much different style. Don't you think sort of Trump would buy more into the whole Macron, you know, style and bling and flash?
You think so, but then he just, I mean, when Macron got up before the joint House-Senate meeting and just basically ripped Trump apart, if you were listening to carefully to his message, I mean, he's very clever about it. But, you know, talking about there's no planet B, the fact that, you know, we cannot have nationalism and we cannot have isolationism. I mean, those are the two foundations of Trump's, you know, make American great again. And his foreign policy is nationalism and isolationism. It couldn't have been a more direct repudiation of what Trump was talking, what, you know, Trump stands for. Yet he embraces the guy and shakes his hand. I mean, it's just like Kim Jong-un. He doesn't care who it is as long as they're, you know, willing to, you know, fawn over him, I guess.
Exactly. That's like the visit to the kingdom. They had TVs every 1,000 feet, you know, with a picture on it. So, but that you, I think you described it, you know, very accurately. And of course, Macron was positioning himself because of the fact that, you know, the president is not liked particularly overwhelmingly in France. So he had his ability when he gave the speech to Congress, and also, you know, number one on their agenda was the climate deal too. I failed to mention that, but also Iran is a really big deal in Europe.
Absolutely, because they're a lot closer.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Bob Ney. We're talking about what's going on in D.C. Bob, we got to wrap up here. But coming up next week, anything that we should be paying attention to? We got anything that on the agenda that we should know about?
Well, once the House chaplain ordeal ends, I guess that you know, there'll be continued arguments. Of course, always Supreme Court. I think the president, I just got one of these feelings, might be doing something in the realm of you know, of visa entry and immigrants, because you know, I think he feels a bit empowered. But the Congress will just continue on. You know, they still have to continue to try to make some kind of budget, because they're lapping way back in their time frame, and that's coming up in October.
And that is not shocking by any means. That's
right.
Kind of the way
exactly.
It is these days. Okay, well, right. Bob, thanks again for
Thank
your help
you.
Today.
All right.
We're going to take
Thank
a break
you.
Here, and when we get back, folks, we're going to talk about our own legislature and procedure. Oh, it's boring, but there's a point to it, and it makes a difference at the end. We'll talk about that next year on the Mike McIntyre Show.
The Spring St. Paul Art Crawl, presented by the St. Paul Art Collective, will be running April 27th, 28th, and 29th. This is a must-do experience that you will love. Over the weekend, you'll have the chance to explore a wide variety of art while touring through local artist studios, lofts, and galleries. Hosting over 350 artists, up for purchase will be paintings, photography, pottery, sculpture, fiber arts, and more. The Art Crawl sprawls over 34 locations. Join the Art Crawl and discover outstanding art for you to own. When you buy local art, you're providing to artists so that they may continue to create the art we love. The Metro Transit is supporting the local art community with free transit passes. Download your pass to ride buses and light rail for free during the Art Crawl. Be sure to get details at the stpaulartcrawl.org. That's the stpaulartcrawl.org.
Enjoy a delicious home-cooked breakfast or lunch away from the kitchen at Milda's Cafe, now open 7 days a week. Milda's Cafe has been cooking up family favorites since 1964. Grab a coffee and sit down for a delicious Philly scramble, house-made rolls, or Denver omelet. Stop in for lunch, where you'll find authentic Finnish pasties every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Open weekdays 6 to 3, weekends 8 to 2. Milda's Cafe on Glenwood Avenue, 4 blocks east of Penn.
At Warner's Deli, we love appliances and our customers. They demand the best, and we wouldn't have it any other way. In appreciation, we put hundreds of appliances on sale at our lowest price, which we guarantee. Now through April 30th, choose from laundry pairs, dishwashers, French door refrigerators, grills, and more kitchen suites than you can count, all at our guaranteed lowest price. Our trusted delivery and installation specialists will get your appliances delivered and installed fast and right. We're Warner's Deli, Minnesota's appliance specialists.
We'll be right back.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. It's a Friday. It's a good day. It's a good day. Fridays are a good day. And I want to look back on the week here and talk about something that happened that you probably missed because it was in the middle of a long debate. In fact, it's a debate that started at 10 o'clock in the morning and didn't wrap up until about 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night. It was on an omnibus bill, which is, it doesn't really matter what an omnibus bill is these days because it seems like more and more of unrelated stuff is being shoehorned together. I mean, agriculture with roads and it just all goes into one big bill. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. And this was a bill that was on the Senate floor yesterday. And we were paying attention because we were waiting for some amendments about gun violence prevention to come up. We had talked about that here yesterday. And the term I wanted to introduce to you, if you haven't heard it before, it's called log rolling. And what log rolling is, it means putting subjects in legislation that's not related to each other for the purpose of getting it passed. It's shoving it down the throats of the opposition since they want something else. But they're going to have to accept it because we've got because they want what else is in the bill. It is against the Minnesota Constitution. In fact, log rolling was the term that people used when they talk about this. The Minnesota Supreme Court, though, has turned a blind eye to this in the past. And so it goes on. It doesn't mean it's right. Now, Senator John Marty called out this practice yesterday when this huge omnibus bill came to the floor.
It was looking at the bill in 600 pages or whatever, and Article 4, Section 17 of the Constitution says bills shall relate to be of a single subject. And I looked up and prepared an alternative title that I think would be equally accurate for this bill, which would be, and this is going to take a second, but relating to practically, a bill for an act relating to practically anything and everything, allowing sugar beet transporters to leak liquids on the road, exempting hair braiders from cosmetology requirements, appropriating funds to clean up two lakes near Alexandria.
Yeah, and this goes on for several minutes. John Marty listing provisions of the bill that obviously aren't related topics, but the author, I believe it was Senator Julie Rosen, said it was a single subject because it was all about government operations. Yeah, that's one single subject. Marty finds that whole practice just really questionable.
You know, we've been here for a couple months now, and it looks to me like 70 to 80% of our entire legislative agenda of policy and budget is wrapped in one bill. And I'm not trying to be critical of people who want to get their provision in it, especially members of the minority, because, you know, this may be the only chance people have for getting an idea even heard at the Capitol.
Yeah, that chance to be heard is exactly what Senator Ron Latz wanted yesterday. He had two gun violence prevention measures that he wanted included as amendments on the bill. So since the bill was about government operations and so were his amendments, you would think that they could be part of the bill because just about everything else was. No. Republican majority has an elected chair who ruled that it was not germane, which means it is not part of the subject of the bill. And so they never really got to debate the actual amendments, and the vote was upheld mostly along party lines. So the rule is here, the problem is when you have the power and you make the rules and you don't allow anything to happen, that's a bad thing. We're going to take a break here, but when we get back, we're going to talk to Jack Rice about North and South Korea. But first, this week's Art Beat.
This is Art Beat for the week.
I'm Lori Fitz from Connections Radio Show, and today I'm bringing you cool events happening this weekend at the St. Paul Art Crawl. To get all the information on events for today, Saturday, and Sunday, go to stpaulartcrawl.org and go to the calendar. I've picked out a few of my favorites for you. There's a 2018 Congressional Art Competition for Congresswoman Betty McCollum's district, and that's tonight from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Schmidt Artist Lofts. It's taking place in the Bottle House Pig's Eye Gallery. This is a national visual art competition sponsored by the Congressional Institute. Or you may want to go to the Arts Weekend from TPT's Minnesota Original, Amplifying the Arts and our culture in our communities. This also takes place from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Twin Cities Public Television, 172 4th Street in East St. Paul. This is an exploration of what art is and what it will be. And this is led by Tecumba Aiken. On Saturday, there are some super cool Make It classes. One that caught Tecumba Aiken. On Saturday, there are some super cool Make It classes. One that caught my eye is from 12 to 1 p.m. at the J.A. Geiger Studio. That's at 1647 Beach Street, St. Paul. This is fun, fused glass mini class on the patio, and that's, of course, weather permitting, to make a pair of coasters, a sun catcher, or a nightlight. Also on Saturday from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Indigenous Roots Cultural Art Center, that's at 788, will perform spoken word. On Sunday, don't miss the Schmidt Spring Art Crawl Scavenger Hunt. That goes from 12 to 5 p.m. It's at the Schmidt Artist Lofts in St. Paul. And what's cool about it is this scavenger hunt will take you through the Schmidt Lofts and to every display. There's a chance to win one of three baskets from the artist. And I think the family day, make and take art, creating an upcycled garden mobile looks like great fun. That's on Sunday from 3 to 4 p.m. at the Carlton Artist Lofts at 2285 University Avenue West in St. Paul. Go to the community room and you can make and take your own sparkly upcycled garden art mobile and check out the various artist mobiles on display at the Enchanted Magpie Garden. So many fun things to do for this evening and all day Saturday and Sunday. Check it out on the stpaulartcrawl.org calendar and go out and celebrate art and community during the St. Paul Art Crawl. That's Art Beat for the Week. I'm Lori Fitz from Connections Radio Show, airing live Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces is having their annual service special. Every stove, insert, and fireplace needs maintenance. Get it done now and save $40. You'll be ready to fire up before the cold weather hits again. From 94, take the Riverside Avenue exit and go east to 2901 Franklin Avenue. See the Twin Cities' most diverse selection of clean-burning, reliable, and environmentally smart stoves and fireplaces.
Hi, I'm Peter Solak, owner of Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces. Have you ever watched your dog or cat curl up in front of a fire like a Norman Rockwell painting brought to life? It's primordial the way fire touches both the animal and the human. We have the equipment and the know-how to supply, install, and maintain stoves and fireplaces. Call us at 612-338-6606 and take advantage of our spring cleaning and maintenance special. We are online at woodlandstoves.com. The mission and the passion of Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces is to make the fire work for you.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, out of the ordinary products and services since 1977.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. We're going to dig a little deeper into the North Korea-South Korea developments today with our local expert on world affairs, former CIA officer and lawyer Jack Rice. Jack, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I got to ask for your first reaction to this. I'm seeing everything from this is the end of Korea War to they've signed peace documents before nothing happened. Was today significant or just good theater, I should say, from North Korea?
The answer is yes. I mean, I think it depends upon whom you ask here. If we look at it internally, then we can talk about it externally. If you look at the world seems to be looking at this, and they're looking at the denuclearization question. And that is a massive part of this. But if you look inside of the Koreas right now, both North and South Korea, this is an armistice that has been in place since 1953. This is one people. And they have been staring across with bayonets at each other now for, you know, 65 plus years. And so from their perspective, I think there was a lot of emotion that maybe this could be one step closer. If you could close this door and bolt it shut, or I should say, frankly, on the other side, you open this door and then lock it open, that could potentially change everything. So from that perspective, I think there were a lot of people who were sitting back watching this as truly a historical moment.
It was great optics. It was a historical moment. The document that the two men signed uses the phrase a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. And that has to just ring some alarm bells back here in Washington, D.C.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, that is one piece of this issue, and that's one of the things that the Americans have been thinking a lot about. What happens from the perspective of the U.S. in Southeast Asia, the U.S. as it applies to the North Koreans, and it really everything else. What happens if the U.S. and U.S. arms actually are pushed off of Korean landmass? Now, frankly, does that make that much difference? In the end, the ability of the U.S. to reach any corner of the globe they can do from anywhere, let alone the fact that they have floating islands called aircraft carriers and subs and everything else, that give them a nuclear and even a tactical nuclear capability right now. But this idea of reaching this point really says a lot. And frankly, I think that Kim is playing this thing masterfully. He truly, truly is.
When you start talking about big shifts like this happening, people start tallying up who won, who lost. Do you see that anybody right now can be called a winner or a loser in this agreement as it stands at the moment?
Well, in the short term, I think you could say that both Kim and Moon are winners here. And dare I say it, even President Trump is a winner here in the short term, because what this does, if we can look at what it's doing for Kim, it's certainly giving him breathing room. And what it's also done is it's created the ability for Kim to sit down with President Trump, technically the most powerful person on the planet. It creates and really raises his profile to an enormous degree. And I think this is something that regularly you wouldn't see, because the whole point of having a slow, a very careful process through intermediaries along the way is by the time you get to the level of two different world leaders meeting or two world leaders sitting down at a table, basically everything's been hashed out and there's a couple of pens. In this case, there's none of that. But in the short term, what it does is it gives Kim room to maneuver. It gives him a really high profile, not just within North Korea, because he's going to be exploiting this like nothing inside of the country, but also on the world stage. That's a big deal. From President Trump's perspective, I think it gives him bragging rights to some degree, at least in the short term, to say, well, what did President Obama do? Well, what did George Bush do? Well, what did George Bush's father do? What did Bill Clinton do? And you can start going back further and further. And at least in the positive sense, he really does have the right to stand up and say, hey, I mean, I got these guys to meet. I got the ability to potentially push this thing to end a war that nobody else has done in 65 years. So that works for him. And even for President Moon from South Korea, he has already said very clearly, this was something that the South Korean people were interested in. This is the desire that he talked about when he ran for office, that he wanted to reach across to the North and pull the North to the table, so he can use that too at this point. So I think in the short term, everybody wins.
I can't imagine our humble president trying to take credit for something like this, he said sarcastically. the White House has often been saying, you know, maximum pressure, maximum pressure. There's been more sanctions on North Korea. Is that what has really brought this about, or was it something else that caused this to happen?
Well, I think it's a whole series of things here. The idea that it's going to be maximum pressure on Kim, the answer is no. I mean, in the end, the real problem is this, is that while you may see a short-term win, maximum pressure, and we've talked about this, the thing is that Kim Jong-un is going to be the first one to eat, and he's going to be the last one to eat in his country. And so if the rest of the country starves, and by the way, under the Kim family, three generations, we have seen millions of people starving within North Korea. So there's no question about that. And they've been more than willing to accept that, or at least Kim has. So the idea that the sanctions are going to starve the people, he couldn't care less. That's very, very clear. But the problem that's coming right now is that in the long term, you may have the issue of the great optics right now. But the real question from the perspective of the Americans and the West, and frankly, the South Koreans, the Chinese, Japanese, and even the Russians, is what's Kim going to do with his weapons? At this point, there's an estimated probably anywhere between 40 and 60 nuclear devices that the North Koreans have, and they seem to have delivery systems as well. They claim they can hit the United States with them. And so the real question is whether or not this is going to make any difference in that state. And that's really what we should be talking about.
So let's talk about what this does with the upcoming summit with Trump and Kim Jong-un. Obviously, it sets up, I think, maybe higher expectations. What do you see happening?
Oh, absolutely it does. I think that the expectations are enormous at this point. And in fact, if the president with, well, I guess his new Secretary of State, Pompeo, what they really need to be doing right now is at every and all levels. This needs to be a full frontal, and I don't want to use the term attack, but at least a full frontal effort to try to get some understanding as to what they're going to talk about. And maybe some agreement as to what is useful and something they can agree to now, not that they would make it public until the two leaders sit down. But they need to at least have a framework in place. They need to have at least a basic understanding of what they're both trying to do, what the expectations are, what they can agree to, at least in the short term, maybe medium and then long terms, so they feel like they're going somewhere. The problem that I fear is that you see two egomaniacal figures, and I think that's pretty clear here, both sides that come to the table. If they don't get what they're looking for, they could actually storm from the room very purposely. And the problem is it could create vast, massive instability in the short term and even longer. And so there needs to be something in place, because I'm not particularly trusting of either Kim at this point or Trump.
Now, kind of left out of this discussion, at least so far, is North Korea's treatment of human beings, of its own people. You mentioned it. You mentioned that it's not been great. It's, you know, can the U.S. make a deal with a leader that has that type of dealings with his own people? Can we ignore those human rights violations?
Well, it's a wonderful question. You know, I was thinking about this today, Mike, and I was just gave a speech this morning, and there is this tension in the United States about whether or not we're concerned about security on one side and stability, which is one piece of this, versus human rights on the other, and the ability of people to find happiness in their lives and our willingness to support that, or even to help them avoid the exploitation and the horrific behavior that has happened in some places around the world. What I think this president has been very clear about is that he was laughing at the West, and specifically at the Americans and our desire to deal with human rights, saying that there are bigger issues that need to be addressed. So I think he cares even less about that issue. But, you know, to not let the United States off in general, the United States likes dictators. We like stability. We like and are willing to accept people being exploited and to some degree exterminated, dare I use the term, because this is what we did with Mubarak in Egypt. This is what we did with the Saudis. This is what we did with the Pakistanis. This is what we did with the Indonesians, with the Philippines, and throughout Central and South America. I mean, this is what the U.S. does. So the idea that they would be willing to accept stability at the cost of lives, I'm sorry, the U.S. has done it before, both left and right, both Republicans and Democrats. This is American foreign policy, not a Republican one.
I look at this, and I think that Kim has gotten what he always wanted, the legitimacy of being a world leader as an equal, and he's the ruler of a de facto nuclear state. Has the United States really lost its leverage with him?
Yes, absolutely they have. No. If there is one major winner, see, as we started at the beginning, you know, who has won here? All three have won to some degree in the short term. But I would say that not just in the short term, but at least in the medium term, we would say that the real winner here is Kim. Because what Kim has been able to do is he's been able to at least shut the Americans down to some degree and the West down to some degree. At the same time, he has made absolutely no promise that he was going to give up his nuclear weapons. None at all, in fact. And so in the end, what he has also done is he will be the first to sit down with a sitting U.S. president. This has never been done before. Now, this is the third meeting that the Kim family has made, so to speak, with a South Korean leader. And the idea that he's willing to step up and do these other things, those are great, potentially, I don't want to be too cynical about it, diversionary tactics. But it, what it does is it placates large swaths of society, not just on the peninsula, but around the world, which gives him even more legitimacy and credibility to continue to do what he does. And so if there is one single winner at this point, at least in the short and maybe medium term, that would be Kim Jong-un.
And if people realize that, how does that help or hurt Donald Trump politically?
Well, I think in the long term, it will be interesting because what I have seen, and I don't think that this is even a left or right issue, what I have found is that this president will take credit for anything and everything that he can, and anything that doesn't go well, he blames on somebody else. I mean, dare I say it, this is narcissism at its best. But it is what I have seen from this president, so it's likely he will pivot around this. And I'm not sure how he'll blame Hillary Clinton, but I'm sure it'll happen.
So if everything goes wrong, Mike Pompeo is to blame. And if everything goes right, Donald Trump deserves a Nobel Peace Prize?
Oh, God. Well, actually, you're close. I don't think you blame Pompeo. I think he's going to blame Hillary Clinton.
Of course.
He's going to blame the... He'll blame anybody and everybody previously who poisoned the well. So I think that's going to be the argument that may happen. But this is interesting. This concept of the Nobel Peace Prize, if we go back and take a look at President Obama and his ability to gain the Nobel Peace Prize, what was it for? I mean, in the end, if you take a look, it was his amazing oratory skills, primarily talking about this sort of new approach to world conflict and some of the speeches that he gave, and they were extraordinary, objectively so. But if we start thinking about efforts to get a Nobel Peace Prize, and you look at agreements between the Egyptians and the Israelis and the U.S., there was something that came out of that. That's part of this. If they were able to get away with this, if this were to work, dare I say it, oh, man, you could objectively say that this president played a major role in ending a war that existed since 1953 and moved these two countries closer together, potentially towards unification, and the ability to limit or at least control to some degree the nuclear capability of the North Koreans. I'm sorry, if you start looking at the requirements for a Nobel Peace Prize, those are there. And you think the White House isn't looking at that? Because I can guarantee that they are.
I got to ask just for a moment, and this is cynical, but how does this play in domestic politics? Because when the president's abroad or the president's involved in foreign policy, the general stance of Congress and the opposing party is to support the president in what he's doing.
Right.
This has not been a normal presidency. Is that what is likely to happen or something different?
Yeah, that's a really wonderful question, Mike, because what we have learned is that you're right. This is not a normal presidency. This is nothing like we have ever seen before. I mean, I can look back at my time, and I worked for George H.W. Bush, and I worked for Bill Clinton. And what I found was that both of them had a worldview, and it was very calculated, thoughtful, introspective in many ways, but it was also based upon a massive amount of information and experience from the people around him. And both of those presidents would defer. And you got to remember, we're talking about at least one of those presidents who was former, was my boss. He was former head of the CIA. He was a very senior on the international scale. Bill Clinton had great people around him, and they all listened to those people. This president does not do that. You remember, he brought in three generals around him. In fact, the argument was made that, well, these are going to be the adults in the room. Well, there's one of them left, and he's been sidelined of the three. The other two have gone. And so the problem is we don't exactly know what's going to happen right now. Because of that issue, he doesn't seem to listen to the people around him. He does what he wants because somehow he seems to he seems to be of the opinion that he viscerally knows the answer, whether or not he actually has the information at his fingertips. And that really plays out. So what it does domestically right now is certainly up in the air. I think that success does garner votes. And if he's able to do some of this, if he's able to motivate the North and South forward, let's face it, it garners votes. You can't deny success. But not to be a cynic myself, if I were Kim, I would hold on to those nuclear weapons like Charlton Heston holds on to a flintlock.
When you pry it from my cold, dead hands, to quote
Amen,
the man
brother.
Who played him. So, okay. Well, Jack, I'm looking at this. Last thing here. We're talking about the domestic impact, and I look at the 2018 elections, and if this works out well for Trump, does it have coattails? Do the folks who have been hanging on here, the Republicans who have been bailing on running again, suddenly go, oh, gosh, I guess we have a chance in 2018 and the Republican Party hangs on to Congress?
Well, one of the issues that's out there right now when it comes to the House in particular, and I think that's really what we're talking about right now, is, I mean, the Senate is potentially there. It's closer just because their numbers are so tight, but the House really isn't. They have more than 20 seats more. I mean, part of the problem that the Dems have, at least on a national scale, is the gerrymandering that's been done at a nationwide scale. We can look at Pennsylvania. We can look at South Carolina. We can look at Wisconsin. There's a whole bunch of cases. In fact, some are up before the Supremes. And they've come down on these issues very clearly. The problem is because of that gerrymandering, Republicans have regularly been very, very successful and capable of keeping seats because they have very, very clean, strong districts. And they break things up in such a way that frequently some minority groups and Democratic bloc voters are sort of split in minority sections of those various districts. And that's what makes it so difficult. Nevertheless, what we have seen is we have seen some huge shifts in the view of what this president is doing to politics. And it's not the Republicans and the Trump supporters, because they will support this president to the end. And it's certainly not the Dems, because that hasn't really changed either. It's that 20% group that are in the middle. It's those moderates who are sitting back here saying, you know what? This is troubling at huge swaths of the country, and yet, if this were to bear some fruit, if there was some success that could come out of this, you could get a larger number of that sort of shifting pie. So this could make a difference.
Jack Rice is the guy I look to help me figure out what this all means, and I hope he helped you today. Jack, I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I always enjoy it.
Coming up next on the Mike McEntee Show, hey, big spender, who is the biggest spender among the Minnesota congressional delegation when it comes to sending you junk mail? That's next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
Hi, this is Paul Metza inviting you to listen to a great new episode on the Wall of Power Radio Hour this weekend. We feature legendary roadie for The Replacements, Bill Sullivan, who's written a great book about his days with The Replacements called Lemon Jail, Life on the Road with The Replacements. Talks about the early days of Minneapolis, New York City, Los Angeles, a bunch of crazy stories, including Scotty, the one-armed mechanic. This weekend, 6 on Saturday, 4 p.m. on Sunday on AM 950.
The fine folks at Common Good Books will help you find the perfect book for you or the book lover in your life. Find a huge selection from a locally owned and independent bookseller in the Twin Cities. They are always bringing in top authors from around the globe for special in-store events. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Find Common Good Books at 38 South Snelling Avenue in St. Paul or shop online at commongoodbooks.com.
Hi, I'm Damian Strange, Executive Director of Northeast Minneapolis Arts Association, NEMA.
And I'm personally inviting you to Arter World May 18th through the 20th. View artwork of over 650 artists in every medium at more than 50 locations throughout Northeast Minneapolis, including studio buildings, art galleries, homes, storefronts, and local businesses. The Artist Open Studio Tour may include demonstrations, mini workshops, installations, and special exhibitions. Studio tours offer a great opportunity to ask questions, discuss techniques, experience art firsthand, and purchase unique artwork directly from artists. Arter World gives you a unique opportunity to meet the artists who make our community so vibrant and invest in our art community by purchasing artwork that you connect with. For more information, go to NEMAA.org. That's NEMA.org. Looking forward to seeing you at Arter World.
Mike McEntee back with you here on AM 950, and the winner is Representative Jason Lewis. Yes, the first-term Republican spent more on taxpayer-funded mass mailings and communications last year, $143,986.74. That's the exact total, more than any other member of the Minnesota delegation. And yes, this is the guy who rails against government spending. I saw some of this hit my own mailbox, mailing after mailing. I got a big mock check for $3,154 sent by his office saying, bigger paychecks are here. Lewis's office says that he believes informing the people of the 2nd District about the legislation he is sponsoring and how to get access to constituent service is a wise and beneficial use of resources. I needed to know I was getting a bigger paycheck. I would have noticed. Or maybe it was so small, you needed to call it to my attention that it actually increased, because most of the tax cut went to the rich. The rest of us got chump change. But here's the good news. This really means that Lewis is feeling the heat. The Congressional Research Office says that mass spending on mass mailings corresponds to the political competitiveness of their reelection chances, meaning if you're spending a lot of money, you're worried about getting reelected. Also notable, Republican U.S. Rep. Eric Paulson spent $59,000 on mass mailings and communications last year, mostly in the fourth quarter, and he's defending his seat against Dean Phillips. That's it for today's show. Hey, support The Uptake at theuptake.org. The Uptake is the source that we have for a lot of the sound and story that we use on the show. Mom, thanks for listening, and we'll be back on Monday.